Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hello, you are listening to the Dork Forest with Jackie Cation. I, coincidentally enough, am Jackie Cation. You know the websites, JackieCation.com, DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com, if you enjoy a determiner. The Dork Forest is a podcast that's on all the platforms, your iTunes, and then I populate it over to YouTube. It's on Stitcher and Pandora and Spotify, but wherever you listen to podcasts, hopefully it makes it available in 1,000 different ways. It is November, and I'll also use this for December. This month, I ask that you not donate to the Dork Forest. If you want to support the Dork Forest, you can. You can order from Amazon using the tiny link that just takes you to Amazon and you order like normal. You can buy merch on the store page on JackieCation.com. You can go to the Bandcamp DorkForest.com and buy extra episodes and stories and stuff if you like to do that. You can come and see me do stand-up comedy, at which my tour is all over JackieCation.com. And in November and December, I'm actually on the road quite a bit, including Minneapolis and Madison, Wisconsin. So those are my... But don't donate. Don't use the PayPal button to donate. And if you're doing it monthly, know that your donation will be going to the LA Food Bank. Because what I ask is that you don't donate to the Dork Forest in November and December, and instead donate to your local food bank. Go to feedingamerica.com if you are in the United States. Put in your zip code, and it'll tell you your local food bank. Or you can just Google the words food bank and the name of your town. That happens all over the world. You can do that anywhere in the world. But just for these 2 months, help people around you. That's all I'm saying. Other than that, we should do the credits. Yes, Mike Rickberg composed and sang that song with Sarah Cohen, his wife, and he will sing his version of the Mexican Hat Dance at the end of the program. Patrick Brady fixes this audio, and Vilmos, still fixing JackieCation.com, bless his heart. Anyway, let's get into the show. Hey, it's Jackie Cation in my living room. I am with Tiffany Stevenson. You are now on the Lady Comic thread that has hundreds and hundreds of posts every single day. Just in case you needed a set, except for that there's very few sets. It's mostly just bitching about stand-up comedy.
I enjoy that. We have a couple of WhatsApp groups like that in the UK.
Oh, fair enough. There you go. So at Tiff Stevenson, S-O-N, Stevenson with a V.
Yeah.
It'll be linked in the notes, is your Twitter. And at Tiff Stevenson Comic on Instagram.
Yeah, I'm trying to work out Instagram. You know, we're words people. I'm not pictures people.
Yeah, the good thing about Instagram is that it is just pictures, and you're like, fine, here you go. This is where I'm at. How about that? And then tiny videos seem to be popular. So that'll be something.
I like that they're called stories, but you've referred to them as tiny videos.
They're tiny videos. I don't think that doesn't feel nobody's doing that prep for it to be a story. I have actually seen some storytelling. Like, I think Jen Kirkman puts a lot more work into it than I do.
Right.
Possibly a Nikki Glaser will do something. Me? Tiny stories. So if you want to, tiny videos, if you want to put a story together, please do.
Okay.
Now, Tiffany Stevenson, you are not originally from this country. You are visiting from the UK.
From the UK, where we have our own disasters happening.
Right. You're also on fire. Congratulations. We're also on fire.
I mean, you're in a hellmouth, like Buffy.
Like, by the way, we're going to be discussing Buffy.
yes, I feel like what happened was we sort of fucked everything up with Brexit, and then you guys looked at that and went, we can supersize that.
We are going to one-up that, and we're just going to light it all on fire.
We need Canada to do a big gulp and take everyone.
Right. They're just like, you know what? There's all of Northern Canada is pretty empty. They still only have like 30, 35 million people. So if you're willing to live in the winter, head up.
I'm not. That's why I'm leaving the UK.
Exactly. You're like, so you'll be back. You did a show at the Improv, and you're going to do again. This will go up the day after.
Yes.
November 4th, you're going to do the Lyric Hyperion here in Los Angeles.
I will be doing that. I'll be doing my hour show, Mother, which is a bit about me being a stepmother, amongst other things.
Okay.
And reproductive rights. I do sometimes get a few stepmoms in, ones that aren't in their castles, talking to their enchanted mirrors. So I had
a stepmother. Did you have a stepmother?
I didn't have a stepmother, no. No.
You had regular bio mom?
My mom, bio. It's like washing powder. I hate that.
Is it too much?
But you had a stepmom. Did you get on well?
Well, we did. She did not want to do it, but she was on board. She's like, we're doing it now. So you will be raised. You will learn how to do chores and your homework. And at the end of it, we will love each other, but no one will know why.
Yeah.
And so it came to pass because she was a great loss to the Austrian army because there were six of us. And so she came and there were charts and graphs and French corners on the beds. And she was like, we're doing this now.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do it either. I never wanted children. So here we go.
Now I've got six of you.
Now I've got six of you. And one of you, kind of handsome, not that much younger than me. Maybe. No. Okay. Never mind. And my brother Terry has always said that she hit on him. And I was like, ew. But I can see it.
Yeah.
She was a sexy lady. She just passed away about 5 years ago. So she was great. She, in many ways, saved our lives.
It's one of those jobs where the reward is, I love my stepson and he's awesome, but you don't get much praise or reward for it otherwise. Like societally, there's a constant feeling of imposter syndrome, I think, with it.
Right. You're definitely, it's screwy. It's not fair because it's a thankless job that you are not thanked for.
Yeah.
And if you are too into it, you're trying to replace somebody's mother. And if you're not into it, you're evil and horrible.
Yes.
So in Nancy Cation's experience, she was like, I don't want to replace her. But we do have to do this because I can't live in squalor. How about that? and so she got bitched at for all the things. But in the end, very little jail time among the six of us. So you got to love that.
Yeah, she did a good job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She raised you right.
She did raise us right. It was, and then it was very funny because of the things she used to say that she never wanted children. And then when she had grandchildren, she used to talk about how much she loved her grandchildren. Never met them. Very little. Was like not interested at all. Like two of them grew up like 20 minutes from her. Saw them like once a year.
Right.
And she was like, I didn't want children, but I'm glad that I have this giant extended family that I can tell people over drinks that I helped be part of their lives. So I think it's a bit of a rip. So I wonder, you know, I never did get her side of it.
Yes.
And so that's what your show is, kind of her side of it?
Yeah. It's, I've done like 9 hour long shows at the Edinburgh Fringe at this point. So.
Right. And every year, something new?
Pretty much every year, although I had a two-year gap between Bombshell and this one. And Bombshell feels pertinent again because that was all about the left politically eating itself.
Oh, like, there you go.
You know, mm-hmm. And I feel that's still sort of ongoing. I even feel like we can't coalesce in the UK. I just tweeted about this today. I was like, any chance we can just put our micro differences aside to focus on the big bad?
Yeah.
Again, to use another Buffy phrase. But like we need to get the Conservatives out. And this sort of infighting between everyone on the left is not going to do it because the right are united in all the stuff that they don't like and disagree right. with, and we're fractured, and we're throwing each other under the bus. No nuance. Yeah,
they have no nuance, and so they can be all one. They can face the same way while they can have racism and homophobia and pretend morals.
Yes.
And the left is like, well, it's actually much more great. Katie Hill got revenge porn, has to resign, and you're like, or you could stick it out and be called an asshole, but. And maybe not get reelected, but you know, you had sex with someone at work. I don't think you were the first one.
No.
Definitely certainly not among the men folk. Anyway, but let's talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer because you're on the Dork Forest.
I'm on the Dork Forest and I want to be dorky about dork
right.
things.
You want to dork out about something super fun. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, gone, like no longer a thing. Did you see the movie?
I saw the movie because it was obviously before the TV series. And it was, I think it's Kirsty Swanson and Luke Perry. R.I.P. Okay. Luke Perry. Oh.
Did Luke Perry die? That's right, he did. And he was only like 50 or something.
Yes.
Younger every day.
Yeah.
That age.
And it was a cute little, I mean, it was for me at the time when that came out, that would be just my, you know, American culture has had such a huge impact on the UK, and especially in your teenage years of your wishes of living this life where you're like, oh, they get to go to prom. These weren't things that we had. Ah. I mean, I think the UK sort of has these things now, but they're
gardens.
Not.
We don't have gardens.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
You have yards.
You have yards.
But the garden, it sounds like there's more work involved.
Yeah. I mean, there's Kent in the UK, which is the Garden of England. But I always say if that garden had like a sofa and a refrigerator, like fly tipped in the front of it.
Fair enough. So there's a
garden is it's all about perspective, I suppose.
Yeah, very much so. As is prom.
yeah, because prom can be a horrific experience, as we've for many people, and Carrie, as we've seen.
Carrie specifically, who I think got her own back, didn't she?
Yes, she
at
did.
At prom, yeah. I didn't go to prom, as you can well imagine. This is does not have the social skills to indulge in some sort of dance. So I did not. I don't know how to roller skate backwards. The bucolic American experience. But I'll tell you, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, she had that cheerleader kind of thing.
Well, she tries to join the cheerleaders and then doesn't get in. And that's what I like about her. She's basically a hero, but who's tackling all of this teenage girl stuff at the same time.
Right.
So I think I was probably, you know, a bit older than it when it came out, but about the same sort of age as the cast that are in it.
Yep. All right.
So it was 1997, I think, it first.
Okay.
Was it 97? Oh, no, maybe it was 90. God, has it been 25 years or has it been 20 years of Buffy? We should fact check that. I feel like it's 97 when it first came out.
I didn't see it when it first came out. I saw it in reruns.
Ah, okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was because, again, it's immediately locking into this part of culture, that you know, also, you know, it had all this stuff about long, it was 97, so I was 20 at the time it came out.
Okay.
And so same sort of age as the cast members, but at what it was so rare to see, bar Sarah Connor from, you know, Terminator,
yep,
to see, and that was a big deal for me because I think I watched that when I was about 11 or 12 maybe, when that film came out, and it was to see a woman just being the badass,
yep,
in the film and totally flipping the script on the original story, which had her as a victim, and in this one she's very much
right the first the I liked the first Terminator movie and I was in my 20s, I think, but the second one was definitely much more just much more powerful because, you know, I spent my entire childhood pretending that Han Solo had a little brother or a little sister that I could be, right?
Yeah.
And so for there to be a woman hero is always a freaking delight.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So seeing that, she saved the world a lot.
Mm-hmm. Every time.
The writing in it, I mean, to kind of write it off as a teen drama, which happened a lot at the time, used to really piss me off because actually the storylines are evergreen. They touch upon all of the big themes that you would get in any good drama. You know, you've got Joyce passing away, this kind of whole episode.
Who
about
was Joyce?
Grief. Joyce was Buffy's mom.
Oh.
And I always
was
say,
that late? Like, wasn't she, like, I think I saw the first three or four seasons the most.
Right. So
and then she went to college.
Yeah, she went to college. She passed away while Buffy was in college.
Okay.
So that was four, I think, series four. Because five was the one where, is five the one where Dawn appears? Maybe it's series five, actually.
Yeah. How and many the years whole, was it?
There was seven seasons.
Seven or eight seasons?
Yeah, hold on.
Okay.
Exactly. This is not right. Very good dorking if I don't know.
No, no, it's
tell
here's the thing about the Dork Forest. Enthusiasm sometimes replaces information.
Yeah.
Certainly from your host, Jackie.
Yeah. No, there were seven. I'm correct. Okay. Seven. So, Buffy's mom, Joyce, who I always joke, like, Jordan Peterson looks like someone that Joyce Summers would date. She had like really terrible taste. Right, in like kind of silver foxes.
Right. She looked like, yeah, and she looked very 80s for
a 90s show.
For a 90s show. And she looked, which kind of made sense because she would have been an 80s 19, right?
Yes.
And so for her to think that that was still cool made perfect sense.
Yes.
But she was a giant mess. And I think, yeah, because I remember in the beginning, there was a lot of her not fitting in the big issues were, I mean, it was Monster of the Week for a long time, right? Mm.
There were a lot of high school themes in that sort of first series of feeling invisible. There was literally an invisible character that wreaks revenge.
That's right. Who played like the oboe or something and crawled in the ducts
yeah,
or something.
Yeah. And then there were the kind of like frat boy.
Oh, that frat boy episode.
Yes. Yeah. There's the beer episode. I think that's into series three. I think that's, or four. That's Buffy when she goes to college. Where they all drink beer and turn stupid, which is a little bit on the nose.
But it was, I think it had a lot of on the nose, but I didn't mind it because it was like, there was the predatory teacher
yes.
who turned into a praying mantis or something like that. Or that was like third episode in or something. It was early, early days.
And there's also, the Hush episode, which is just, which was in series, Hush is the one, it feels almost like very gothic,
one?
Like Tim Burton-esque. It won Emmys and everything else.
What was the plot of that one? I vaguely remember the name.
It was series four, so it's when Buffy's at college, and it's about these men called the Gentlemen.
Yeah.
And they go around stealing hearts.
Oh, you know, here's the thing. You loved those college years.
Yes.
That's hilarious, where she had the boyfriend who was in the army or something.
Oh, but he's a terrible character as well, so there is that.
Well, he was all right for, like, I think the first half of season, Riley.
Yes, but and he didn't like that she was stronger than him. He was a man that was struggling
yes.
with the fact that there was a woman who was more powerful than him
mm-hmm.
and more morally kind of like able to see the nuance.
Right.
He was an army guy. He was very much black and white, good and evil, this is bad. And she's
right.
like, actually, now we're in season four of Buffy.
Right. And Spike is involved. And
yes, there's more moral relativity. And Spike's not getting killed straight away. You know,
right.
they want him dead. But the Gentlemen steal the voices
first. That's right.
So you can't hear them scream when they take the hearts. So there's it's an episode without it won like kind of best script, and they were
okay.
like, "Oh, the irony of this being there's hardly any dialogue in it,
right?
You know,
right?
So the idea is that they wake up one morning, they can't speak,
yeah,
and they're kind of like draw it's slapsticky, it's very funny,
yeah.
But the Gentlemen are super super creepy. They hover off the ground.
Yeah, they're all in suits or something, and they're just sort of floating along, right?
They're floating along, and it was very reminiscent of, there was a film with Rufus Sewell where they turn back the clocks in the night. I don't know if you remember this film.
No.
Rufus Sewell and Richard O'Brien were in this film where at night they would go out and turn back the clocks and change everything round. Dark City.
Dark City?
Yeah.
And when was that? When did that come out?
That came out in 1998. I think it was heavily influenced by
Buffy?
Buffy was heavily influenced by
Dark
movie. City. Yeah, because it's all these creepy bald men just floating around doing stuff. And horrible teeth as well. That's the other thing I remember. Like kind of like almost pearlescent, glistening teeth.
Wow.
You know, and that's... You know, there's all these underlying themes within that as well as of like having your voice and being able to speak up. And again, it's Buffy who Riley finds it difficult to deal with the fact that Buffy's the one. She's like, Buffy's bluntness in like, how do I stab it? How do I kill it?
Right.
And, you know, they're going, no, we need to come at this because she can be a blunt instrument as well.
Yes.
You know.
Right. Cool. Because there's Angel initially.
Angel's the first boyfriend who then becomes the big bad when they have sex and it turns him evil.
Right, because he wasn't supposed to. And he should have used a condom.
Yeah.
Probably would have.
Should have used a condom.
Probably would have
left
helped.
That vampire jizz in
that's
a condom.
Because that's where it all went wrong.
And, Is it dust? Is that how it works?
It might have been. It might have been like a placenta where he should have then eaten it. I got gross. Okay, so.
So he was the first boyfriend and they have sex and he turns into a ship, which I think is a story many women understand. And I think that's one of the beautiful things. Actually, it was totally relatable about how she's got all these vulnerable feelings of like, I've had sex with my boyfriend and now he's being horrific to me.
Like, right. There's that weird thing in the beginning where he doesn't want to go out with her. He's thousands of years old. She's 14.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all these...
Same old Hollywood story.
Same old Hollywood story. It's just like... And then he gets talked into it. This is the romance novel the guy's always been looking for.
Yeah.
And But the... When they end up... You know, it's that unrequited love kind of thing that then when it is resolved, I think Joss Whedon was like, this ruined Moonlighting. We're gonna just embrace the fact that it's going to ruin it.
Yes.
And then the only way that he could get better, didn't he have to go off and start his own TV show?
Yeah, that's how men get better. They get given more career opportunities. Men behave badly and are given extra chances.
Extra things for him to do, but in another town.
Yes.
He couldn't stay in Sunnyvale. He had to go... because Sunnyvale, California.
Sunnydale.
But Sunnyvale, yeah. California is a real place.
Oh, right.
And so, and the recurring joke has, ever since the 90s has been that it is a hellmouth. And now it is an IT hellmouth because it's all Google and
tech.
And tech and stuff. So, because it's in Silicon Valley. But,
So he goes away. He goes away to start his own series, which is Angel, eponymous show Angel. And then there are various love interests because obviously there's a situation that happens with Spike and Buffy. And then there's...
What happens with Spike and Buffy? I don't remember.
He sacrifices himself at the very end for her and he is in love with her.
Oh, okay. Because I know that he was a great character.
Spike's story arc is probably one of the great, you know... Because
tragic.
She hates us. Yeah, she hates herself for being with him and he's in love with her and she doesn't tell anyone because she comes back from the dead. They bring her back from the dead.
Oh, that's
And she's
right.
changed.
Right.
As you tend to be.
As you would be if you were brought back from the dead. What season was that when she comes back from the... Because it was her sister?
Her that sister, brings her she back? Sacrificed herself for her sister.
Okay. How Hunger Games of her.
Yeah.
And, so.
Yeah, Katniss. It's been done before. Get over it. So she is, I think that's, so Dawn and the Key. So we had series four. Did Dawn come in?
There's Willow, right?
Oh, Willow. Yeah. Allison Hannigan.
And the boy that she's in love with. Who's like Skippy from, he's like the neighbor kid from that TV show. Xander. That was his name.
Like watching TV with my mom. It's that guy.
Oh, very much so. It's, I was born like this. So when I was 8 years old, I'm sitting around
Skippy.
Going, it's like Eddie Haskell is what I was saying when I was eight. And it's like the Beverly Hillbillies. It's like their neighbor who's like Eddie Haskell.
Uh-oh.
And anyway, so.
So there was Nicholas Brendan, who's Xander, yes. But then Willow...
Is he
you
going
know,
on to do anything? Nicholas Brendan, that you know his name is amazing.
Not as much. He's actually a twin, interestingly. But Alison Hannigan obviously has gone on to have a pretty big career because she's in How I Met Your Mother and she was in the American Pie movies and stuff.
Did she play Willow?
She played Willow.
She is the talking head host on the Penn & Teller Fool Us TV show.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Right.
So she loves magic, it turns out, and has a gig where she gets to introduce people and be part of Magic X.
Oh, that's great.
So she enjoys that.
That's fitting. Mm-hmm. So she's actually married to Alexis Denisoff, who was in Angel and Buffy for a little while. He came in as a replacement watcher for Giles, who was Buffy's watcher.
Oh, that's right. Giles, who... Whatever happened to Giles?
Well, he was in a Maxwell House coffee ad in the UK. That was the most famous thing he'd done there.
Whatever happened to his character, though? Because I remember, didn't they get recalled or something?
He leaves. He leaves her just when she needs him the most because he thinks he's not necessary anymore. I mean, this is where just brilliant characterization. There's also Anya, the character Anya, who's played by Emma Caulfield, who when Buffy's mum dies in an episode, just does this explore because she's a demon that is newly human.
Okay.
She gets to experience all the human emotions for the first time and they're right at the front of everything.
Yeah.
So it's really just beautifully done. It's such a gift of a character to be able to have, because she says, I don't understand what's happening. I was just here drinking fruit punch, and I thought Joyce would like some fruit punch, and she's not here anymore, and she's never going to drink fruit punch again, and then she's, you know, and I don't understand it, and how do you live this, because it hurts so much, and it's just like this beautiful, like, really, you know, and she's got funny lines where, like, someone talks about being anxious and she's like, why don't you just masturbate like the rest of us, you know. So she's a great, you know, I did so much, I could probably do a whole episode on this, and I know we want to talk about other things, so
no, that's all right,
but it was an absolute gift to see this complex layered character going through all of these teenage emotions and growing and learning, but also still having to be the hero the whole time.
Right. So, but yes, because Buffy kind of had to be both the adult and the child. And yes. it was such an ensemble cast. I mean, he's really good at ensemble casts, yes. Joss Whedon. And so there was the dark haired woman who was the cheerleader, who was kind of bitchy.
Charisma Carpenter, yeah. She played Cordelia.
Cordelia.
She went on to be an angel, and she had a really interesting story arc in that, because she was kind of initially brought in as kind of like the airheaded, vacuous one.
Right.
But who then falls in love with the geeky guy.
Oh, right. She falls in love with Xander.
That's right. And then Xander and Willow have a thing, but Willow's actually a lesbian, and then she has a relationship with Tara.
And then becomes a witch.
Becomes a witch and then turns bad. It, like, evil Willow, pretty brilliant.
Yeah.
She flays someone in an episode, which is pretty hardcore for...
That does feel for high school or college. Was that the college years too?
When that was college years. And actually, that's the thing that they call the fridged women. There's a trope within comic book culture, which I just learned about yesterday, called fridging, which is... like these women that only exist so that men can go on a hero's journey.
Yep.
So the woman they love is murdered or killed, and it's called fridging because the Green Lantern comes back to find his girlfriend in pieces in a fridge. Right.
What a weird, deep, long box cut. Holy crap. So Hal Jordan comes back and his girlfriend or wife is in a fridge?
A fridge, yeah.
And so now he has to go on like a Taken kind of revenge?
Yes.
All right. Didn't John Wick, someone kill his dog recently? And
But this is the journey that men always get. And for women, it's when their kids die, they go and explore doing things, right? So
we're going to get you back.
We're going to get you back. So, but in this case, Tara is killed.
Oh, right.
So this is Willow getting to do that journey. So that's, even then, he's kind of subverting that. We're getting to see a woman do this kind of my lover was killed. I'm going to do that revenge plot line, and I'm going to flay someone. Like, right. She literally takes the skin. It's quite a shocking moment for what that show is.
Yeah, because there usually isn't much gore. I didn't see that episode where they show some of it?
They show it. She just flicks at him, and his skin comes off.
Oh, Christ.
So it's quite graphic. You're like, whoa, like hardcore Willow.
Because you think when you first start watching, when you first watch Buffy, you're like, oh, good, there's no bodies, right? All turn into dust and they blow away.
Yes.
So, but when you, when something like that flank shows up, or when the monster is particularly, remember that guy who lived underground, he was under the earth and wanted to come and take over the world?
Yes.
And he needed a portal or something?
Yeah.
And it was a little boy. Remember that one?
Yes. That was, I think, when they brought Nathan Fillion in as well. There was like an order of monks.
Was Nathan Fillion in that?
Yes.
So okay.
Joss has a team, you know, because then Nathan Fillion went on, obviously, to be the lead in Firefly.
Right.
Which was also a great TV series.
An amazing TV. And a great film, Serenity. Yep. Those are, it's great. And then I liked the woman who was the pilot in Firefly.
Yes.
You know her name?
Gina Torres.
Nice work. You have got all these names in your brain box. Well played.
And she's married to Lawrence Fishburne.
Is she married to Lawrence Fishburne?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I saw her as a lawyer in some other hour-long drama. So I'm glad she's still working, because she was amazing in Firefly.
Oh, Firefly was such a good show again. And obviously, that's the beauty of Joss Whedon. He does know how to write these brilliant women and make them complex and layered. And that's why, that's why it was so groundbreaking and revolutionary at the time.
Yeah, he's really good at ensemble casts, and he's really good at writing women. I guess it was some sort of a bit of a buzzkill, because it turns out he's also human, and he likes the ladies, and so when He's not great in a, right. in a power right. situation. I guess he's acted incorrectly occasionally. And, but much like Dan Harmon, I think, and maybe not, like, I know he didn't apologize like Dan Harmon did, but I think he can be taught, is from what I've heard of Joss Whedon, is that he was like, that wasn't great, dum-dum.
Anyway. I think sometimes with the slightly, and this might be me speaking out of turn, I think sometimes with the slightly nerdy guys, this goes across stand-up comedy, or whether it's producers, writers, directors, they start as being these outsiders and then they are embraced and they don't realize they have power in the same way, right?
Right. They still think they're the underdog.
They still think they're the underdog and they sort of become monsters and they don't realize that they're like, oh, no. Like, there's no way you would do this just because I asked. She right. must have been into it because I'm a piece of shit and everyone thinks that and I don't have any power.
Right. And
That's not excusing it, by the way, please, right, for no one listening. But this is nuanced. These are exactly the kind of conversations that need to be happening, right?
Right. Because, and there's a learning curve to it. You have a stand-up comic in your country who has always thought of himself as the underdog and for a while was not the underdog, had to relearn how to do stand-up, I think, because it was a bad couple of years with Stuart Lee.
Right.
Where Stuart Lee was the underdog, and he was a yes. piece of shit, and nobody gave a shit. And so he said whatever he wanted, and it was great. And then he got a TV show, and he became more powerful. And then you're like, dude,
you're not the underdog
anymore.
You are
no longer the underdog.
Yeah.
Get it together. And yes. so I think it took a couple of years. The same we have Doug Stanhope here.
Yeah.
And but I think you're right about that, is that – but it they need someone in their lives, or they need to have realization in their own lives where they have to come to the other side of it and realize, oh, no, I'm management now. Yes. I am the man. And yeah. so and to use their powers for good. Because I think Joss Whedon has used his powers for good for the most part.
Yes.
You know, maybe not in individuals' lives. But that yes. is true of me as well. I've been a piece of shit to occasional individuals who would like me to stop that as well. And they are not wrong. But do you have a favorite episode or a favorite arc?
Yeah, I think... because Buffy runs after Riley when he disappears. I do kind of like the... I kind of like the Hush episode.
Oh, right, because of how dark and weird it is.
Yes, but also the Buffy, the one where Buffy's mum dies.
Just because is it mostly the powerful ones that really get you?
Yeah, I felt like it was handled so, because there's a silence. It's almost like Bleach, the way it's shot. It's called The Body because she just comes in and finds a body.
Right.
So she comes in going, mama, and then she's on the floor. And then it's realizing that she's not alive. But it's kind of this kind of, it's almost like she's gone into shock. And the shock is shown really well because all the sounds, it's just this kind of
muted,
pastoral. It's kind of like,
oh, wow.
You know, like kind of you can hear birds.
Yeah.
And it's over bleached. There's sunshine, sunshine, sunshine. But it's very quiet and there's no dialogue. And she's trying to get her up, then she phones an ambulance and then she literally walks off and throws up,
yep,
and comes back in, and then you just hear the siren and it's beautifully done. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of as much in part of like the cinematography and the like how the episode was directed to really, mm-hmm. because what you're putting on the page there, I think it was Jonathan Ames said this to me once, he was like, the problem with scripts is they're too much like blueprints, they're schematics, mm-hmm. which is why I like writing prose, right?
So yeah.
This feels like, you know, how did this is in the hands of the director, or this is in the hands of someone going, because I don't know how you write this.
Oh, right.
To make that these kind of moments really sing, because it's not in the what Buffy has that is great is zippy dialogue between characters, yeah. bouncing backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. And it's really
often
funny.
Very quippy and so, funny and like that. So
she meets Dracula for the first time, and he's like, "I am Dracula." And she's like, "Get out!" You know, like it's great. It has that. You know, I'm and Xander going, "I'm tired of being everyone's butt monkey." There's like great bits of, but this is all in the all in how it's kind of graded and edited and shot. So much of it, and her performance in it is really really great. But so that's probably one of my favorite episodes, which is a bit grim, but yeah, the body. Yeah,
it's so interesting because this is very much light fare, right? Mm. Like, it's not particularly well respected, or it wasn't at the time. It was like vampires and high school kids and who cares and all these things. But I have been recently been thinking about how much power is in these lighter movies and these lighter books and things that are just sort of, they feel more casual. Like, you know, like when you look back on like the beginning of science fiction popularity back in the, where the heroes were a lot of the, you think it's a cowboy movie where it's just good and bad and black and white, except for that it's Heinlein or somebody, or it's Ursula Le Guin, where there is nuance and there is, and in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, this is an opportunity to talk about like real pain and real like angst and real just shitty behavior in general, and really shine a light on it because there's vampires. You're like, oh, she's going to stab somebody. And but then you have actually learned something in the midst of it all, right? It's like, it's like the best of the superhero movies.
Yes.
The best of science fiction, the best of romance, romantic comedies. You know, and I've said this a bunch of times on The Dork Forest, that there's always like in these lighter books and stuff, and movies, there's always a B plot. There's always some sort of weird message.
Yes.
And whether it's right wing or left wing, it is, it's there. It's so fucking there. And like I've been watching on a pretty steady rewatch, like a tiny child watching Aladdin, the movie Long Shot. And it is Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. And it is a romantic comedy, and it's not realistic. And I have said this out loud before. I was mad about it because I thought that Seth Rogen has sort of purchased himself a trophy wife of a movie.
Yeah.
Because what is Charlize Theron doing in this movie with Seth Rogen, where she's a love interest of Seth Rogen's?
Yes.
But it makes sense in the plot, and the script is hilarious, and there is a bunch of little zingers in it. You know, it has sort of this it's much more cynical than The American President, right? The American President had Annette Bening and Michael Douglas, right? So why would there be someone at my door? Hang on a second. And we're back. I just yelled at a guy for no reason. Yeah, then I had to apologize because that's how my life goes. Hi, Tiffany Stevenson.
At least you apologize, though.
Right, because right as I saw his eyes widen and go, what? Did I just rang the doorbell. I didn't do anything. I just rang the doorbell. And yeah, it was AAA guy. He was at the wrong house. It was one house over. My lovely neighbors. They're very nice. He seemed like a nice man. Not the hero. Not the hero of this story, you guys. Let's keep going with Tiffany Stevenson. What is the lesson we've learned there? What? Because I'm going to eat a cashew.
Yeah, the lesson we've learned there is that that you know when you're wrong and you can apologize immediately. And look how simple it was.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad.
Say sorry.
It was not that hard. He took it well, too. He was just like, yeah. You'll notice he did not say, no, don't worry about it. He said, yeah, no, you're right. You're right to apologize because you were weird. And he was correct. Okay. So, Buffy the Vamp. I mean, here's the thing. On your list of other people.
Lots of things. We can move on.
We could because comparably, like you have Maya Angelou.
Yeah.
And Charles Dickens on here.
Charles and Eve Babbitts. Speaking
Who's
of
Eve
authors.
Babbitts?
Eve Babbitts was like a Hollywood it girl, but then that's kind of to diminish her. She's a phenomenal writer. And the first time I came out to Los Angeles, a friend of mine brought me a book called Eve's Hollywood, my friend Steve, and said, you've got to read this if you're going to do Hollywood. And it's about, it's at the beginning, she sort of thanks Joan Didion for being disparaging about being that New York writer who's then disparaging about LA so that she doesn't have to do that because more like a love letter to LA.
Oh, that's neat.
Eve Babbitt's work. It's really rich. It's really layered. It's so smart and ahead of its time on a lot of things on like,
But she's a writer.
Beauty privilege. Yeah, but she was beautiful. So she was like in the, her, I think her father played, was a violinist for a studio.
Studio violinist.
Yeah, studio violinist.
Oh, wow.
And
that's thankless, steady work.
Yeah. So, and her parents, so she sort of grew up in Hollywood. And she is the person, but she was kind of an it girl for that phase, and then was doing photography, photographing rock stars at one point. And this is just memoirs of her hazy kind of smoke and drinking years, hanging out at the Chateau Marmont. And
it is the 70s or?
70s, yeah, 70s.
60s and 70s or 70s and 80s?
Mainly 70s, I think. But okay. Her school years were kind of like 50s and 60s, and she talks about kind of pachucho culture, which I didn't know a huge
what
amount
is that?
About. So that's like a Mexican kind of, it was like a culture, a fashion. There was pachucho and pachucha.
Okay.
And it's in terms of that they were influential with music. It was really interesting because she says at the time everyone aped Mexican culture. Everyone wanted to be like the Mexicans, including the black singers. Everyone wanted to sing like this one kind of famous Mexican singer at the time, and we wanted to dress like that. And they were seen as the cool people in culture. And then I think one of the big singers got arrested for statutory rape.
Okay.
And there's a but this is how she is on like racial politics. She was like because he was Mexican, she was like, that's not condoning. But she was like, also at the same time, he slept with underage girls, but so did, why aren't they arresting, you know, the Rolling
Stones?
Everyone else. And she was like, because they were white.
Yes.
So the Pachuchos had, you know how like, I guess like how everyone dresses in the mask, you know, these big kind of, it was like the big pants with the sort of spats and the slick back hair and a chain hanging down from the, you know, it was the original.
That was the look?
That was the look. And she said there were two Mexican kids in her school who were like, they used to have a dance competition in the gym on a Friday. And she was like, they were by far and away the best dancers.
Right.
But they would never win because of the inherent racism of the teachers and everything else. So there's this kind of unpicking of Los Angeles culture at the time.
And sort of the co-opting of that culture.
Yes.
And taking sort of like what we know happens, but it's mostly the most of the examples are usually with African American.
Yes.
Work.
Yeah. So she was like, but everyone, you know, wanted to be like them. And then it kind of moves through into, she's got great stuff on beauty privilege and how people split, like how, you know, who the type of people were, the itinerant people that sort of showed up in Los Angeles looking to create a life versus the smart, you know, like that kind of idea that the smart ones went to New York and the beautiful ones went to Los Angeles.
Right. Back in the, yeah.
Yeah. And she talks about beauty privilege and how, and these are conversations that are being had now, but she's talking about it in the 70s. It's so far ahead of its time. She had a great bit on kind of like a friend of hers who just was like, everyone's just so nice to me and they want to help me all the time and it's because I'm a good person. And she was like, no, it's because you're beautiful.
It's because you're Super Fox. Hey, yeah. Super Fox. And you're young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's like, but she's never jealous of it and it's not resentful. It's like kind of, she's able to step back and view it on almost like in an objective fashion. Rather than obviously, you know, subjectively getting upset that this isn't her life. And, you know, she's someone who's beautiful as well. One of the famous photos of her is playing naked chess.
Okay.
With the chess grandmaster. And those were like a series of photos that came out in the 70s and 80s. So I just think if you're in Hollywood, reading Eve's Hollywood, you get a real sense of, you begin to feel Los Angeles in your skin.
Ah.
You begin to wear it. So she's talking about being in Cantor's Deli and observing people having conversations and her descriptions of stuff, almost like Confederacy of Dunces, almost like Ignatius, how he uses this kind of really a certain level of hyperbole to describe something that's quite mundane, that's very funny.
Okay.
Like, and that the first time she ever ate a fig, she was like, I thought a fig was an assault on the senses. Like the idea of it. But like the idea of her being 10 years old and kind of going, this is like the worst thing that could ever happen to a human.
Right.
Just kind of reminds me of Ignatius when his mum tries to get into his room and his response is, never has one human being been so totally and utterly besieged. So I always really enjoy that kind of level of hyperbole in writing about the mundane, and she does that beautifully.
And so she, I've never heard of her. Is she just, is, and the word just, of course, but is she just a writer? Is she?
Well, she was the person who introduced Salvador Dali to Frank Zappa.
Okay.
You know, she's that kind of, she was a person who brought people together.
Okay, so she was like sort of a social...
socialite, sort of, but like, that undermines but, how funny and great her writing is. Does that make sense?
Sort of LA royalty, but also really, really good at it.
Yes.
And
she's 76 now.
Oh, she is still with us.
Yes, but she kind of disappeared from life, public life. I think she had an accident or, you
just
know.
Just a wipeout of some sort?
Well, it was I think she got burnt and she sort of disappeared from public life for a bit. She used to make album covers, so she would do, you know, so she was an artist in that. She designed album covers for Linda Ronstadt, The Byrds, Buffalo Springfield.
Oh, wow.
So she did her most famous cover collage for the 1967 album, Buffalo Springfield Again.
Okay. I know someone like this is Diva Zappa was on this show.
Right.
And she is a photographer and she follows bands. And she is also, her dorkdom was knitting. And my favorite thing that Diva Zappa said about knitting, because I said, well, knitting seems very... like if you make a mistake, it's a hard thing to undo and then redo. And she goes, oh no, I never redo. I always think that's what the hat wants. And I was like, yeah, does it? And she goes, oh, I know. But I'm not undoing it and redoing it. I'm just going to, and she also liked to pick the hardest kind of, yarn. Like the most ethereal kind of like fluffy yarn of all of the hardest kind, where she's like, okay, I'm going to use this and learn how to knit using this weird cotton candy of a yarn. And so she brought some of her knitting and it was, but she grew up as sort of that kind of royalty as well.
Yes.
Where, you know, I'm friends with Moon, and Moon's been on the show too. But Moon's dorkdom is more this sort of like yoga spiritual stuff,
right?
That was truly dorky, but not. It's hard to put. It's hard to get your hands on it,
right?
And but there's so much. It's interesting when someone who is raised like that in this situation would write sort of a love letter to that town, to the place where they came from.
Yes.
So yeah. That's cool. Did so just the one book or?
Oh no, there's a few. I've been given one of, I've been given one of like, of her short stories. I think she was published in Rolling Stone and The Village.
Okay.
She went to New York for a little while and really hated New York. But hated how much, that LA was referred to as a cultural wasteland when she was actually like, culture is built here and this is a beautiful place.
The people who hate Los Angeles are incorrect. Whenever I go anywhere and if somebody slams LA, I was like, you know, I choose to live here.
Yes.
And here's the thing about Los Angeles that is one of the greatest things is that Karen Kilgariff, I think, said it best. She said, Every couple of months, the best looking people in their small town move to Los Angeles to find out that they are not the best looking people in the world. And what I find is that every 6 or 10 months, I'll meet a half a dozen to a dozen new, brand new comedians who have just moved here. And four of them, like Tiffany Stevenson, and four of them will be incredible. And then the phone rang. This is the most interrupted episode of The Dork Forest ever.
It could be. It could be. Yes, to find out. So four comedians will move to find out that they're not the best comedians.
You know, a dozen comedians will move here. I'll see them. I'll meet every 6 or 8 months a dozen new comedians. And four of them will be incredible.
Right.
And I will say to them, why have I never heard of you? Why aren't you famous? And then they will say back to me, well, you're pretty good. Why aren't you famous? You've been here the whole time. And they are correct as well. But but the thing is, there is a problem with some people who move here. There's two things that happen that make people mad about Los Angeles. They move here and they don't realize that they have to start over. You know?
Right.
If you come here with a set of skills, you win, right? Mm. Because once you get an opportunity, then it's like someone
else. You're ready for it.
Yes.
You're primed.
Someone can get you a job. They cannot keep the job for you, right?
Yeah.
So in Los Angeles, if you're ready to be seen, if you ever get seen, you have an advantage. But so starting at the beginning of open mics and just showing up and doing that kind of legwork feels beneath some people. They're like, I was a big deal in Indianapolis. And you're like, yes, but you are no longer in Indianapolis. And so, and then the other thing that will sometimes make people mad is if they decide to go home.
Right.
You know, they've given it a shot and they go home and they get made fun of back in Minneapolis or in Chicago. Oh, you couldn't make it, huh? And you're like, hey, fuck you. Did you try?
Yeah.
You didn't try. You stayed here and didn't even go out and see if anyone gave a damn. You know, because a big portion of the industry has always been here, right?
Right.
But, you know, but the world we're living in now, you can do it from Chicago. You can do it because of the internet and have them, you can live there and still make a big deal here. So,
yeah. You can hop between London and New York and LA, which is what I'm doing.
That's it.
But I get it. But there is a kind of thing of like building a career and then coming here and then kind of going, okay, no one knows. So I have to go out and do stuff and do shows and hop up. And I'm willing to jump through hoops, but I'm not willing to jump through all the hoops again.
No, because
so that's where you kind of draw your line. You go, there's a bit of hoop jumping, but there's also...
I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
There's part of me, like when I moved here, I think I was 31. And I was like, I can do this, but I can't do all of it. Like you said,
yeah.
Because I'm tired. And,
yeah.
And hopefully the effort that I put in will result in something.
And I know there are a few people who fling themselves out here without anything else and just go, I'm in Hollywood. I want to do it. And it is, I guess it's different. You know, I have a body of work. So I like to think that
you bring that
for itself.
To the table.
Yeah. And, a TV career and stuff in the UK. But also, you know, it's all relative as well.
Right.
You know, but people can see your work here or hear you. Like I do the Bugle podcast. So people will come out for shows from hearing me on that out here.
Yeah.
So you can start to build your audience from your hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And London obviously being, you know, the place where there's so much comedy happening. Kind of similar to New York. LA is much more spread out. But it's a much more even-handed approach to the business for someone who's like me. I do stand-up, but I don't just do stand-up. I act in stuff and I write.
Yeah.
So Hollywood does feel like the place to be to do that. There's just not a huge amount of money in...
No.
In stand-up.
But I love the fact that the Eve Babbitt's thing brings you to this town.
Yes.
With more of a sense of hope and more of a sense of inclusion and love instead of a... Because when I moved here, I was told that I had to choose to like it. It was the best advice I ever got.
Right.
Because he said, if you don't choose to like it, you will probably not like it because there are things not to like.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, okay. And he said... And you're going to hang out with people that you don't like very much in any new place that you move for the first year or so. And then eventually it'll take you 3 years and then you'll meet four people that you genuinely really like. And then you will build a community around that.
Yes.
And he has been, I don't hang out with him anymore. What happened there?
But I do think I do kind of try and go with my gut as well on people because you'll meet a lot of, there's a fair amount of bullshit is in this town. And that's what she talks about in her book as well. There's a certain type of guy that will kind of come over and just assume that you have no agency or idea of what you're doing, even though they've just seen you be funny on stage.
Oh, and they
kind of go, I can help you. Listen, I know what to do with your career. And then I find out that they've never got a single thing away or written a thing. You know,
it feels like that negative talk where they're
negging.
Just, yeah, which is, I hate all abbreviations. So, but I think, yeah, so that negging business, it just, they can make you feel bad about themselves and somehow climb, attach themselves to your, to your yeah. qualities, right?
Yes, yeah.
And it doesn't, I mean, every time I get off stage and someone, I'd never really noticed it before. I would just get a vague feeling. Like, I just did stand up in Paris and Rich Hall uh-huh. was the headliner yeah. of Snigglet's fame.
Yes. And Rich does my show in London, like on a weekly.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
He was enormously dismissive of me. And so he was not particularly nice. It doesn't mean, it just meant he was having a day when he didn't feel like, you know.
Ah.
And it's fine.
That's a
but
shame.
It was a shame.
That's yeah. But yeah, go on.
And sorry. So I just sort of, I was like, oh, well, I don't need to stay and watch his set then. Because I got off stage and I did well. And they asked me to do an encore. So one imagines, which was weird, because there is no encores
yes.
really in stand-up comedy in Los Angeles or in the United States.
Right.
There's because I just did my closer. I don't know if you
yeah.
anyway. And you hired me to yes. do the 35 minutes. So I get off stage and the booker was like, "Can you go do an encore? Another 10?" And I was like, "Is Rich not ready?" And he was like, yeah. No, I think the audience liked you so much they'd like to see more.
Right.
And so then I got up and I did 10 of something. And then and it was fine, but he was there for the set and he didn't say anything. You know, he didn't say good set. He didn't say it's been nice to meet you. He was like essentially just he looked dead in the eye and then he turned and walked away. So I was like, I don't know what to do with that. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to dinner. And that's how I dealt with that.
Yeah. Well, no, because it is, it's what we know the rules, right? And there are rules that after a comic's been on, and they've done really well. Withholding your praise is such an odd thing to do.
The best case scenario, it's an odd thing to do. The worst case scenario, it's kind of mean.
Yes. Yeah.
And purposeful. Purpose because yes. because we do all know that even if it didn't go well,
yes.
if it went okay, you just go, hey.
Hey.
You were up there. No, yeah. you don't say that.
Well, but I mean, you kind of go, mate, like, or you point out the bits you did like.
Yes.
And you say, wasn't it great when you did that bit and that? And you try and give someone something positive to walk away with. But I'm upset. I'm disappointed that Rich did that because
you know him.
Because I know him. And also because when I do my room in London, he's there the whole night. So he watches everyone. He's there
That's
from
neat.
The beginning of the, you know,
which is enormously supportive.
Yes, but maybe was he pissed off that you got an encore and you weren't closing? Like, I don't understand.
Who knows?
That he was going to go on later and he was like, oh, now they're going to be like worn out by the time I get on.
Well,
but also, none of that is your fault.
No, no.
So to kind of get to do that is like, you know, that's...
It was weird. But I will say that... The whole thing was weird because he was called in last minute because Will Durst had a stroke.
Right.
And I got a text message from a couple of comics going, hey, you're in Paris. Will Durst had this mini stroke. Do you want a set? And I was like, hey, you fucking ghoul. How's Will Durst? Did
yes.
he live?
Yeah.
And and they were like, yeah, he's fine. And I was like, yes, I want the set. But don't bury the lead.
Yeah.
Will Durst had a stroke. He's okay.
He's okay. Yeah, we need that. I need that piece of information
yeah,
up front.
Yeah, let's not make me into the monster that, of course, wants to crawl on top of his body.
And I'm aware that also this is a business that is very much, like I like that I'm already on a female comics thread, but I feel like that people... I have this kind of sense of honor amongst thieves, for want of a better phrase, you
yeah.
know, of like kind of comics supporting each other, being there for each other, and also trying to make it better for everyone. I feel like people at the top have to be campaigning to make it better for people at the bottom.
Yeah.
Because they're the only people that can affect the real change.
Right, because nobody's listening to the
yeah.
people on the bottom. And if you're in the middle and you say something, there's some risk there.
Yeah.
But there's less risk than the people on the bottom. And, you know, pick your battles, I guess, but say
yeah.
something. Don't just fucking let it be horrible.
Don't let it be horrible, yeah. And that's...
I'm thinking of getting a tattoo. Anyway.
Say something.
Don't let it be horrible.
Don't let it be horrible, yeah. But, that's kind of... Ugh. Disappointed. And disappointed.
I know. But here's
and frustrated the, for you.
But here's the great thing is that there is so much sort of encouraging things that encourage us, you know,
yeah.
like that book is encouraging you to like Los Angeles.
So this is what it says. Here's a paragraph from it. Although I have no, oh, okay. The '50s, as everyone points out, was a peculiarly charmless time in which to be an adolescent, but no one ever felt more bliss than I, accompanying an older girlfriend to unemployment or inventing lives for fractionally viewed, careless young men in Jaguars. Though wow. I have no kids and Hollywood doesn't exist, I firmly believe, however, that it did exist. And like Rome, we are living amidst the fallen columns and clothesline courtyards in the ruins of an empire of the self-enchanted, which was once briefly more devastating than Caesar's and still brings respectable families to a hot, windy intersection in August to sigh with unnoticed despondence. Well, here we are, Hollywood and Vine.
Wow, that's an amazing... You know, there are things, you know, like you'll read somebody who's trying to write something.
Yes.
That is something that makes, it's beautifully written, right?
Yeah.
Like the prose is outstanding. The use of words is extravagant. And the imagery is big. But it is also, it makes sense.
Yes.
There's no hidden, weird, it's not cryptic, weird Instagram, the longest post in the world, where you're like, what the fuck is he saying?
Yeah.
And it's not just big words for the sense of big words.
Well, and it talks about, I think it's about her grandparents when they first arrived and they found themselves on the corner of Hollywood and Vine.
So in 1950?
Kind of, well, she was a teenager in 1950, so they would have been earlier than that. And
wow.
So it's just kind of this, what the ideas of Hollywood are. And what are the real things that you can grab onto? And she's fascinated by people. And I'm fascinated by people because I'm a storyteller at heart. Even in my stand-up, you know, I'm trying to tell stories.
Yeah.
When I'm writing, I'm trying to tell stories. And she finds people fascinating. And I have a little writerly exercise that I do before I ever read this book. And it feels to me like a thing that Eve Babbitts would do. Is sometimes I'll go out in my car and I'll drive through a neighborhood.
Okay.
Near me, but one that I don't know well. And then I'll go down the street and I'll pick a house and I go, who lives there? And I will make this series of assumptions or create a story out of what I see in the yard.
Through the window?
Through, well, yeah, but without being a creep.
Right,
you know,
right,
yeah.
Not being
crazy. So you could see a wind chime hanging in the garden.
Yeah.
You take something from that. Do they have potted plants? Is there a pond? What kind of car are they driving?
Yeah.
And then you just create a world around the people that live in there. And I start to write a little story and it's like an imagined life of someone.
Right.
And I've got a new thing that I've done, which I want to do. I think Instagram's the place for it. I'm not sure. But it's called The Imagined Lives of Ladies. And I have photographs that I brought in like it would be like a garage sale in
or
New
estate
York.
Estate sale or something.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. They're just pictures, but they're pictures of women and they're pretty much through like 20s and 30s up to the 80s.
Right.
And I want to take this picture and then create the story.
Yeah, this is without
this
getting
person.
In your card. Car.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think an Instagram account with that would be real fun. And I want to write the funny stories.
That's
you know.
Cool. That's a great idea. I love, there's so much, Tiffany Stevenson, what I like about you is that there's so much hope in your, like I get from you like this palpable intelligence but I also get this sense of just moving forward into something. We've got to do something and we have to stay sort of chipper about it. Not chipper, but I mean like more positive, like don't wallow in
yes.
the things that are, you know, it doesn't deny that they exist.
Yeah.
But
stop hammering on the door that's not going to open for you and just go round the fucker. Like honestly, like I feel like, because then part of me like feels like, I'm entering into some kind of madness because I'm coming over here at this point in my life, you know, and I'm
right.
not in my 20s, but I also do feel like I have something to offer. And then I've, you know, excitingly, I've got some things away and stuff is happening, you
yeah.
know, and, but also I'm coming to this point of like having done stand up for a long time, having done Edinburgh's, having shows be like the best reviewed shows in Edinburgh. And I hate saying that because I do.
But someone should.
It's in my nature to be self-deprecating, and right? It's not Hollywood's nature. People aren't afraid to like shout their achievements, and they're not afraid to look desperate here, which is really interesting. But, you know, but sometimes that also pays off, like that kind of like I need mm-hmm. squeaky wheel thing. Mm-hmm. But what I'm realizing is that I view it all as art. So, you know, I believe stand-up is art. And now I'm trying to be less judgmental when ideas come in that I go, is that a piece of stand-up?
Right.
Or is that something I want to put into a script?
Okay.
Or is this just a little fun adventure I want to go on here and...
Right.
You know, because stand-up is not the only filter for all of my ideas. And stand-up's more the filter for my personal experiences of the world. And then sometimes I do bring characters in and stuff. Like
yeah.
I met a tour guide in New York a couple of years ago who was the basis for an entire show, my bombshell show.
Because,
really? Yes, because he had a group of about 20 people. And this is word for word. I was with my friends and they were like, oh, that's gone straight in your iPhone notes. And I was like, of course it has. Because this guy goes, over here we have pier number 37. This is where the Titanic was supposed to dock. We all know what happened here. Tragedy. And then he went, anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? That's, how is that tour? How? I just, this guy stuck in my brain. It was like a little like worm in my brain. Just a man saying tragedy, moving on.
Yes.
Because people fascinate me.
Yeah.
And I was trying to work out what he means in the greater scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took me a while, but I got to, and this was the basis of the show, but I got to, so like Eve Babbitt's, I'm fascinated by people and watching people. Snatches of conversation fascinate me.
Right.
So that was, I was like, oh, he represents all of us in this time of rolling news and terrorism and natural disasters and tragedy that we barely have time to acknowledge.
Right.
What's happened before we have to move on.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Tragedy. Anyway, moving on. No more. Isn't this horrible? Anyway, next thing. We've run out of toilet paper. Let's move on. So I think I can't remember how I came off onto this,
well,
but yes, I'm trying
because
not
the
to,
different uses for
yes.
the stories and the things that come into your mind.
Yes,
yeah.
and so that ended up being the basis of a show about how we receive bad news, how we receive these events, and how ultimately we always try and make them about us because it's our ultimate way of understanding and processing. And I think stand-up is a way of understanding and processing
sure.
the world that we live in.
Which is why everyone can do a joke about the same thing and every joke will be different.
Yes.
You know, just because when it's well done, obviously. But I mean, like, but if you need to talk about airline food, you need to talk about it.
Yes.
And you make it your own and you do whatever you got to do to make it interesting.
So there's no such thing as hack topics, just a hack approach.
Yes, a terrible hack approach. Very, very, it happens. We've all been there. But it's so interesting because I've done a couple of solo shows where I've taken that information from those solo shows and put it in my stand-up because the stories themselves are stories, but I tend to write funny stories.
Yes.
And they have some punchlines in them, and then I can add more punchlines, you know, and then we tighten it up and we sell it as stand-up.
Yes.
And it's all good. And I tend to do more storytelling in stand-up anyway, which is...
Yes, I've seen you. So I love the kind of the story element or I don't know if passing out's the correct word of it, but that kind of bit of it starting of being a... which is all great stand-up that I love and I hope I do as well, where it starts out as something that happens to you, but what does that mean in a wider context for society
right.
and to everyone else?
Right. Maria Bamford has this bit about how she wants to spice up her sex life with her husband, but some people like to act out different scenarios, and the only scenarios she knows are sort of unfixable social issues. So she's like, so the first one she does is gentrification.
Right.
And so they're acting out gentrification in a sexual fantasy. And you're like, what is happening? And it's the big world made small.
Made small.
Or the smallest thing in the world made enormous.
Yes.
Right? So, Yeah, it is. And to get back to Buffy, that's what he does. He takes something so absurd and big, like vampires and high school, and then making it very, very personal. So,
Yeah.
It has been an hour, even though the interruptions have not been, there's been a lot of them. I don't know. I usually unplug the phone. There's things that happen.
Well, we talked about stand-up a bit, and I hope that's okay for people listening, because we can be dorky about stand-up, right?
We can, for sure. It's usually organic because I have a lot of stand-ups on the show. And so at some point, there will be a 10-minute chunk about stand-up comedy as we meander around the stuff we're reading and the stuff we're watching on television. So Tiffany Stevenson, everybody, if you are in the UK and you want to see her there, is there a tiffanystevenson.com?
Yes, this is, tiffstevenson.com.
There we go. And it's at Tiff Stevenson on Twitter and at Tiff Stevenson Comic on Instagram. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been real fun.
And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Thank you. Why don't we just...